Today on the 21st show, the campaign to be the next U.S. Senator from Illinois after Dick Durbin's decision not to seek re-election. Next up in our series, Democrat Jonathan Dean. He's a lawyer and solar energy entrepreneur. He's also open about his experiences as a survivor of childhood abuse. We'll talk with him about issues both personal and political. We also want to put your questions to Mr. Dean. You can call us throughout the hour at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey with Jonathan Dean for the hour today on the 21st show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. Our series of interviews with candidates for the U.S. Senate race in Illinois continues today. This is to succeed incumbent Dick Durbin, who is stepping down at the end of his term. Early voting is underway across Illinois. Primary day is March 17th. If you want more information on the candidates, by this point we have talked to many of them on the show. This is our 12th interview in this series. You can find those at our website, 21stshow.org. My guest today is Jonathan Dean, who's running in the Democratic primary. He is a lawyer based in Chicago. He went to the University of Minnesota for college, earning bachelor's degrees in public relations and economics. A few years later, he went back to school in Illinois, earning a law degree from the Pritzker School of Law at Northwestern University. For the past several years, he's been handling civil litigation in courts across the country. He's also a solar energy entrepreneur, having started a business for developing solar projects in Illinois in 2023. And he has been an advocate for survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And consider that your warning for potentially sensitive subjects in today's conversation. Dean is now one of the 10 candidates running in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. He joins me today from our studios in Urbana. Jonathan Dean, welcome to the 21st show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Ryan. Thank you.
And listeners, you can join us today at 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. So you're originally from the St. Louis area? What was it like growing up?
In St. Louis?
Yeah, just tell me about, you know, where you grew up, what the environment like, what the atmosphere was like.
Yeah, so I grew up in the western suburbs of St. Louis. I grew up a Cardinals fan. Hopefully the folks up in Chicago don't hear that, especially on the north side. But yeah, it was a great place to grow up out in the suburbs. I grew up going to Catholic school, both in elementary and high school, and ended up graduating from high school from Chaminade in St. Louis before heading up to Minnesota for college.
What drew you to Minnesota?
So actually, my father got a new job up in Minnesota, and you know, these are the days in the late 1990s, early 2000s when remote work wasn't a thing yet. And so, you know, University of Minnesota at that time, when I was a senior in high school, wasn't really on my radar. But with my parents moving there, I took a look at it, and despite the fact that it was windy and snowy the day that I was on my on-campus tour, it felt good, and so I decided to go there, and it worked out good because that's where I eventually met my wife.
Yeah, state tuition probably helps too.
It does. It did.
What made you want to go into the law?
I had always been attracted to the law. When I was growing up in St. Louis, in the fifth grade, we did a field trip to the old St. Louis courthouse that is in the shadow of the arch, and did a reenactment of the Dred Scott case. And I was cast to play one of the lawyers. And I was like, you know, hey, this is something that I could really get used to. As I walked around the courtroom, gave arguments, I was attracted to the intellectual rigor of it. I was also attracted to the public speaking element of it and being out there in front of people and being given the challenge of making a persuasive argument that would hopefully win the day.
So I mentioned you are also an advocate for survivors of childhood sexual abuse, and you talk about your own experience of that on your website. I want to follow your lead here with how much or how little you want to get into this. But first, I'm sorry you went through that.
Thank you.
But can you just talk about, you know, how that's affected your life and work?
Yeah, so great question. Being a survivor of childhood sexual abuse has the effect, whether we as survivors like it or not, really has the effect of, you know, determining the course of the rest of our lives. And so that is what I think happened to me. I think that given the outrage and indignity of being abused as a child, that's one of the things that led me into a career as a lawyer, wanting to seek and realize justice. And, you know, over the course of my life, I'm not going to lie, as folks will probably understand, it's been a struggle to, you know, first even remember that it happened. It took me till I was 30 years old to even have a memory of it. And that's not uncommon. And then for the first several years after that, as one can imagine, just dealing with, coming to terms with that this happened in my life, that it has shaped the direction of my life, you know, from the time that I was very young, 10 or 11 years old, until, you know, this time when I was 30, 31, 32 years old, really without me knowing it. And so there's also this several year process of just kind of coming to terms with, this happened, this is my life, this had a profound impact on my life, and this is something about myself that I need to study and learn about more and come to terms with. And, you know, eventually with support through that process, I did.
I wonder also if there is some, I don't know if lesson is the right word here, but something to be thought through in terms of power and the church, certain, and, you know, the power of faith leaders and just power in general in our society and how it's experienced disproportionately by certain people.
Yeah, that is, you hit the nail on the head, right? You know, when you mention power in terms of childhood sexual assault, because a lot of people make the misunderstanding that the sexual assault of a child is about sex, and it's not. It's about power. And in fact, of course, a child, anyone under the age of 18, legally and also emotionally, cannot consent to sexual contact with an adult. And, you know, as a child, you know, a 10 or 11 year old, especially back in the 1990s, before the prevalence of sexual education and things like that, there's just really no understanding of an adult, you know, concept of sex. And so, as you mentioned, there is a massive, massive power dynamic. And you mentioned the Archdiocese. I was sexually assaulted by a priest in the Archdiocese of St. Louis. And I eventually came to the point in my recovery as an adult that I was able to file a lawsuit, which eventually settled, and get some measure of compensation for that harm. But I would consider myself among the lucky ones for several reasons, because a lot of times, and I spoke about this after the settlement of my lawsuit, a lot of times the law, just in a variety of different ways, I don't want to get too legally technical, but in a lot of different ways, the law really disfavors survivors of sexual assault, and in particular, survivors of childhood sexual assault. And then even if a survivor is able to file a lawsuit and not have it dismissed, pursuing justice is an emotionally grueling process because the defendants, whoever they are legally entitled to what is termed in the legal world discovery. Before trial, each side to a lawsuit is able to ask a number of questions, do interviews, which are called depositions, of the other side, and as a plaintiff in a lawsuit that is alleging childhood sexual abuse, the defendants are able to basically get any record that's been generated about me in my entire life. That's not an exaggeration. I remember signing off on a records request for my employment records for when I was a lifeguard, my junior year of high school. That's not a joke. Wow. So they were able to get everything. And so it's a very, very invasive process. And a lot of times you hear folks talk about it being re-traumatizing for them.
Yeah. And I appreciate how willing you've been to speak about this publicly, both here and in general. Maybe this is a way to pivot into the sort of public policy aspect in your campaign. You mentioned briefly that the law can disfavor people who are trying to seek justice in these sorts of cases. What has been your experience of, you know, what has your experience taught you about how public policy is made and executed in America that maybe relates to why you are running for Senate?
With regards to childhood sexual abuse, or
yeah,
just
that
generally?
In particular, I guess, as a way to pivot into the broader conversation.
Yeah. So my experience with this was largely dominated by laws that every state has, which are termed statute of limitations, and with the Epstein files being in the news, there's actually a lot of additional discussion about statutes of limitation in cases alleging the sexual abuse of a child. There's a lot of discussion about that currently. But what happened in my case is that, you know, Missouri had a 5-year statute of limitations that in the legal world is termed, it's told when someone is a minor, when someone's in the case of Missouri, actually under the age of 21. So that statute of limitations is told does not start running until the victim turns 21 years old. And so under the ordinary operation of the statute of limitations, then it starts running when the victim turns 21, whether or not the victim remembers the abuse or not. The Missouri Supreme Court actually intervened to interpret the statute of limitations as having a repressed memory exception for victims, for survivors of childhood sexual abuse, and stated that the statute of limitations is additionally told, meaning it does not start running, until the victim has their first memory of the assault. And I would say, in light of there being a 5-year statute of limitations, that interpretation of the law is good for survivors, but it's still not great, because what eventually happens is that the plaintiffs and the defendants, so the survivors and the alleged perpetrators, end up arguing about when the survivor had his or her first memory of the assault, which is, of course, something that, you know, there's really no objective measure of. And so after my case settled, I spoke in a press conference in 2023 that you know, folks can find on YouTube if they're interested, if you search Jonathan Dean press conference, that talks about just how ridiculous it is to have a statute of limitations for claims of childhood sexual abuse, given how psychologically a lot of times folks don't remember until they're well into adulthood, and just the kind of ridiculousness of arguing over when did somebody have their first memory of something. That just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you for talking openly about this. We need to take a break in a couple of minutes here, but maybe before we do, I can ask you the sort of basic question I ask of everybody I've spoken to in this campaign. Why do you want to be a U.S. Senator, Jonathan Dean?
I'll answer a slight variation of your question. I'm running for this seat because I have two small kids and I'm scared for their future. That is really the only reason why I'm running. And so I guess a corollary of that is that I want to be a U.S. Senator to actually have a say in the future for my kids, for everybody's kids, for our future and for my future, because the way that I see it right now, our government just isn't functioning to solve problems or to plan for the future.
All right, we're going to take a break. We are speaking with Jonathan Dean, who is one of the people running in the Democratic primary for United States Senator to fill the vacancy that will be created by Dick Durbin's decision not to seek re-election this year. If you want to join us today, if you have a question or comment, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. I also mentioned at the beginning of the program, I'll say it again now, this is the 12th interview we have done with candidates for U.S. Senate. The primary is coming up March 17th. If you want to seek out some of the other interviews we've done, you can find them all at our website, 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. We'll have more with Jonathan Dean after a short break. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest for the hour today is Jonathan Dean, one of the people running in the Democratic primary for United States Senator from Illinois this year. This is our 12th interview in this series. We've now talked with three quarters of the full field of candidates in both primaries. The election's coming up March 17th. Although early voting is underway now across Illinois, you can find our past conversations at 21stshow.org. You can join us today at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. All right, let's talk policy, domestic policy. We'll start there. The killings of Alex Preti and Renee Good in Minneapolis are still weighing on a lot of our minds. You went to school in Minnesota. You live in Chicago. How have you been thinking about what ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and the Border Patrol have been doing in Minneapolis and Chicago?
Yeah, so I've just been personally scared. I live in Chicago, like you said. I have had ICE in my neighborhood. I have kids who are 7 and 5 years old, and I've taken them to school and been scanning around because, you know, I don't want to see some large, you know, federal agents dressed in paramilitary gear with assault weapons when I'm taking my kids to school. And more importantly, I don't want my kids to see that. I think the most important thing with my children, or really any children, is they need to feel safe. And this deployment of ICE is into family neighborhoods is just not a thing that is conducive with public safety. It's certainly not a thing that makes me feel safe, and it's almost certainly not a thing that would make a child feel safe. So I want to just start with my personal experience. And also, I think it's telling that we've never had law enforcement, federal law enforcement, or really even state-level law enforcement deployed like this. I could say a lot about what I think about ICE and what they're doing, but I'll just kind of limit it to two things because I know that we're time limited here. We've all seen or heard about the shootings. I call them murders of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis, and we've all seen or heard the official government responses, and we can all use our own eyes and our own ears and our own judgment. And a lot of people, myself included, have come to the conclusion that those shootings, those killings were absolutely unwarranted and outrageous, and that the official government response, which at times was put out minutes later on X or social media, but certainly hours later, was not thought through, and to the extent it labeled Miss Good or Mr. Preddy domestic terrorists is outrageous. And I'll say one additional thing about this is that it's my belief and assessment, both just as a citizen, but also as a lawyer, that the ICE deployment should be ruled unconstitutional. The immigration law, unconstitutional in and of itself, because, you know, the immigration laws that ICE is tasked with enforcing are either civil violations, so, you know, like kind of on the same footing as a traffic ticket, or misdemeanors. You know, 95-96% of the crimes that they're enforcing, you know, don't even rise to the level of felonies, yet they're enforcing these nonviolent crimes with violence. And I think as Americans who live in a free society, most of us can agree that law enforcement should not be enforcing nonviolent criminal violations with violence.
What do you say? Yet just yesterday on the program, we talked with Tony McCombie, who's the Republican leader in the Illinois House. And like many other Republicans I've spoken to in the past few months, they point the finger of blame at Democratic leaders in states like Minnesota and Illinois, in cities like Chicago and Minneapolis, for fomenting unrest and saying, film these people, get in their way, that sort of thing. How do you respond to that accusation that Democratic leaders bear some of the blame for some of the violence that has followed from these enforcement actions?
I mean, I think we need to give, you know, American citizens credit for being able to use and exercise their own judgment. Sure, you know, leaders say things, and they're leaders for a reason. We've elected, you know, Brandon Johnson in Chicago or J.B. Pritzker in Illinois to be leaders. But this Republican narrative that I've heard so much that, you know, it's their fault for fomenting, you know, some kind of unrest, it just doesn't make any sense to me as a citizen who has had personal experience with ICE in my own neighborhood, because as I stated earlier, I'm scared by it. I am outraged by it. And in my entire 43 years on this planet, I have never seen law enforcement deployed in this manner, in particular to claim to be enforcing the violation or claim to be enforcing, you know, crimes that are nonviolent with such violence. So from my perspective, I see citizens who are just as outraged as me and would be doing the exact same thing, whether or not Governor Pritzker or Mayor Johnson had said the things that, you know, Republicans are repeating.
How do you think about future accountability, right? If the Democrats can retake the Senate, should there be hearings about what's happening now? Or, you know, this is a point of contention. Or should Democrats, you know, focus on price of butter, price of eggs, that kind of thing, and say, well, the past is the past. And, you know, maybe it's even a broader question to say, when we think of future accountability, of even rising to the level of criminal prosecutions, perhaps, for some of the constitutional violations that have been alleged here.
Yeah. So To answer your question broadly, I think Democrats should do both. And, you know, luckily there's several different committees in the Senate where Democrats can focus on economic issues in one committee and, you know, including the price of butter and, you know, cost of groceries and home affordability. And then also, you know, do an independent investigation of ICE conduct and conduct by the Department of Homeland Security during these first few years of the Trump term. And I do think that there needs to be an independent investigation, not just about, you know, how ICE has operated in these cities like Chicago and Los Angeles and Minneapolis, St. Paul, but also how were they ordered to operate? Because it certainly seems to me like they're following orders, and because Republicans hold both Congress and the White House, you know, they've simply refused to issue subpoenas to the executive branch about, you know, what the orders to ICE and the Department of Homeland Security have been. But I think as part of an independent investigation, that it is my hope that, you know, regardless as to whether I win this race or not, but certainly if or when I do, I would push for this, that there is an independent investigation into all of this conduct. And I think, you know, given the disapproval ratings that we're seeing, upwards of 60-70% of Americans disapproving of ICE conduct, I think we all just need it. You know, a term that's used in the legal profession sometimes is kind of a truth and reconciliation commission. I think in the Senate, it would take the form of a Senate Select Committee to investigate the abuses by the Department of Homeland Security and ICE. But I think that's an investigation that needs to happen just so that the government can atone to the people and rebuild trust and faith in the government. But also, as you said, so, you know, there can be referrals for criminal prosecutions, which I agree with.
All right. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jonathan Dean, one of the Democrats seeking his party's nomination for United States Senate here in Illinois. The primary is coming up March 17th. Early voting is underway now. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. So I mentioned you're a lawyer. You're also a solar energy entrepreneur. I understand you started a business for developing solar projects in Illinois in 2023. Talk to me about the Trump administration. They've been rolling back climate regulations, including an EPA rule that was the basis for a great deal of federal climate policy. How have legal developments, in the Trump administration affected your work in particular and the field more broadly?
Yeah. So, you know, luckily I started this business, Solar Endeavor LLC, a few years ago here in Illinois, and Illinois has been great in terms of encouraging development of solar energy projects. We're ahead of most other states, maybe except for Minnesota, that, you know, started a decade or two ago with encouraging solar. So my business really has not been impacted yet. What's happened in the program for developing solar energy here in Illinois is that the Illinois Power Agency and the Illinois Commerce Commission have bumped up a lot of the solar capacity that is available between now and 2030 into this current program year, which closes in a few months. And that's because the tax credits associated with solar energy development from the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed under Joe Biden and then repealed by Republicans last summer, those tax credits are now expiring at the end of this next summer. So we're working extra hard to get some projects in the pipeline before those tax credits expire. That's from my business perspective. You know, from a policy perspective, I just don't understand the attacks on wind and solar energy. We're at a time in this country where we need more electricity than ever, where everyone agrees that our electrical grid is outdated and needs updating. And so responding to that by killing reliable and cheap sources of energy like wind and solar is simply madness to me.
It's all a culture war, right? I mean, it becomes part of the issues that people just choose the red jersey or the blue jersey on.
Unfortunately, I think that renewable energy has gotten caught in that political framing. And when I talk about it, I try to take it out of that political framing. And I first and foremost think that it falls into the discussion about affordability, because, you know, I don't know if any listeners out there have had the opportunity to generate energy from solar panels, but I will tell you from personal experience that it is an amazing experience, because once the investment in the solar panels and the electrical equipment is made, the energy flows. You know, the energy is free. And on these hot summer days, you know, those panels really, really generate a lot of energy. And it is a great feeling to harvest energy from them. It's a feeling of personal autonomy and personal responsibility that you don't need to rely on anyone else for your energy needs, whether you're getting it, whether you installed them on your home, or whether you subscribe to a community solar garden like the ones that my company develops. And it's going to save you money. So, you know, I don't like that, you know, renewable energy has gotten caught up in this framing. I think it's gotten caught up in the framing because the fossil fuel industry is intimidated by it, because it is a cheaper, cleaner, more reliable source of energy than fossil fuels are.
Let's stick with domestic policy. What can the federal government do to improve the economy, especially for Americans with the least income and no wealth to speak of? And I do have to say, we have to take another break in about 2.5 minutes here.
Sure. Thanks. Yeah, I'll try to make this one as speedy as possible. If you promise me we can come back to something like it. But I think there's short-term and long-term fixes. Short-term, you know, folks are struggling now. And so there, folks do need some immediate relief, you know, especially, you know, certainly folks in the middle class and folks who are living paycheck to paycheck. So I think on an immediate basis, something that can be done is allowing folks to pay for personal necessities, you know, mortgage or rent, childcare, student loan payments, groceries on a pre-tax basis. That's effectively a tax cut for folks and is going to lower their overall taxable income. But on a long-term basis, we need to address the economic structure in this country, in that it's prioritized for the top 1% and wealthy corporations and not for the rest of the 99% of us in this country.
Did I see you're calling for an increase in the minimum wage?
I am, yeah.
What to what level?
$26 an hour. And that's a number that if we would have pegged the minimum wage to inflation in the 1970s, that's what minimum wage would have been if we had pegged it to inflation back then.
All right, maybe that's a good point to pause, because I do want to dig in on that a little bit. And the word inflation is going to be part of the next question. We'll leave that as a tease. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Jonathan Dean. He is one of the people seeking the Democratic Party nomination for U.S. Senate for the vacancy that's going to be created when Dick Durbin steps down or reaches the end of his term in early 2027. Early voting is underway now across Illinois. Primary election day itself is March 17th. You can find other interviews in this series at our website, 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. You can join us today at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. We'll have more from Jonathan Dean after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today we are talking about the campaign for U.S. Senate here in the 21st state. We're doing our 12th interview with one of the people seeking their party nomination. Today it's Jonathan Dean, running in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate for the seat being vacated by Dick Durbin. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. Dean is an attorney based in Chicago. He grew up in the St. Louis area. He's also a solar energy entrepreneur, as we heard. And we were talking before the break about domestic policy, particularly the economy, and just gotten into the point of potentially raising the minimum wage. Dean favors $26 an hour. So let me ask you about that. If it goes up, and you mentioned, just to be fair, you mentioned that was if the wage had been pegged to inflation from the 1970s, the minimum wage, that's where it would be today. If the minimum wage goes up, businesses raise prices, suddenly we're in another inflationary spiral, which, at the risk of sounding glib, you know, my read on 2024 is if eggs wouldn't have been so expensive, we might not be dealing with an authoritarian attempt today and masked, you know, badgeless or numbered, you know, ID-less federal agents roaming the streets in major cities, if we hadn't had that inflation. So how do you address that? How do you deal with that if you really do some of these big swings at minimum wage increases?
Yeah, so yeah, I appreciate that question. Thanks. And, you know, there are probably some small business owners listening who are like, oh my gosh, $26 an hour would put me out of business. And, you know, this kind of policy is just not something that we change in, you know, just kind of by itself in this kind of all of a sudden change, you know, minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $26, you know, and the next day it's $26 an hour. You know, certainly I think there would need to be some kind of phase up to $26 an hour to take it slowly, and so that we don't shock the economy, like you said, add additional inflation to the economy. So it would be a gradual process. There might be some small businesses who are exempt from that level, but this goes to something that I talk a lot about on the campaign trail, is that we can't just in our politics get trapped between this binary kind of argument where it's like, if we raise minimum wage, then it's going to do this and it's going to like destroy this. It's like the economy is a lot more diversified than that. It's a lot more complex than that. And Congress has the ability to investigate and study these things and collect the very best information about how to make a transition like this in a way that is the least disruptive as possible. So I with all due respect, and I do appreciate your question, Brian, but I kind of reject these political arguments where it's like, well, if you do this, then all these other bad things are going to happen, because that can be avoided if we set about raising the minimum wage the right way. And do I have all of the answers right now? I don't, because that's something that folks in Congress need to undertake to, you know, talk to the best economists and coordinate with the Treasury Department and the Fed to decide how to restructure our economy so that it works for working people. And that's the fundamental, you know, zooming out for a 10,000 foot view, that's the fundamental problem with our economy right now, is that it is built to prioritize, you know, the top 1 or 2% of earners, of wealthy businesses. And that's how you have this phenomenon in our economy right now, where economic growth is great, but regular people are struggling.
Yeah, and look, the need for nuance, the idea, there's this Thomas Sowell quote I say a lot, there are no solutions, only trade-offs when it comes to policy. So I believe all that. Of course, what fits in a 30-second ad and you know what passes for political discourse in America often is at variance with nuance. Look, we have 10 minutes left. I want to I do like to spend a little time on foreign affairs, because that is a big part of being a United States senator, is dealing with foreign affairs and advising the president on that. We could talk about Israel and Gaza. We could be talking about Greenland. We could talk about Venezuela, but I think, and Ukraine. I think the big picture question, though, that looms over American foreign policy today and wraps all those things together is, should America continue to seek to be a global superpower, as we have been since World War II, and as the Trump administration and MAGA and America First seem to be pulling us back from?
Great question. And so, you know, I will say I think that is what MAGA and Donald Trump ran on, this America First policy. I would disagree that is what they are governing on, especially since they've been saber-rattling about Greenland, which I'll just say I think is ridiculous, and they invaded Venezuela at significant cost to American taxpayers. And so I don't think that is how the Trump has governed. I do think that we could use a pullback in terms of how much American taxpayer money is invested in foreign wars, and look at reinvesting the tax dollars that you and I and everyone else in Illinois pay back into actually our own communities. And that's something I talk a lot about on the campaign trail, where if we just, you know, take small slices from the Defense Department budget and put that more towards education, that's going to have a profound impact on outcomes for our children. I do want to say a few things about some of these conflicts, these overseas conflicts that you mentioned. But before I do that, I also want to say, you know, what happens when, if we were to have this circumstance where America just kind of completely pulls back from world affairs, what happens is that other actors out there fill the void, Russia, China, and they may not act in our interests, you know, and that starts to impact things like global trade. And so I don't think, and I'm not a proponent of America completely pulling back from foreign engagements, but we do need to look at the amount of money that we're spending overseas and in foreign wars and really dramatically pull that back and be a lot more strategic about it. And one example that I'll just give is that, you know, there's $300 billion of Russian assets that are currently frozen in Brussels that President Trump could seize and provide to Ukraine, and that would support their ongoing defense for years. And why he hasn't done that, I don't know.
All right, let's go to the phones. I think we can get a couple of questions in here. We have Paul calling from Urbana. Paul, thanks for calling in. And time is short. I have to warn you.
I wanted to talk about mixed farming and solar developments that maybe you've gotten into. And there's an idea that the farmers have a big sway in politics, but it's actually agribusiness and the Farm Bureau that are pulling those strings. But on the idea that Trump can unilaterally seize those assets, that's the kind of ridiculous, we want Greenland. I mean, it's just a corollary to it. There are international laws, and that just, you've been very mild spoken, and but that's just, I'm getting apoplectic. But so, and then also, I think every Democratic senator interview I've heard has been asked about Israel Palestine too. So I realize.
All right, Paul, let me try and wrangle that into a line of questioning. And Jonathan, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Jonathan, let's take these as quickly as we can, looking at the clock ticking down. I know you can see it in the studio there. So Israel-Palestine, do you think what happened there can be properly categorized as a genocide?
I do, yes. And, you know, I don't understand why that's up for debate, because the experts on genocide and international law at the United Nations engaged in extensive fact-finding and legal analysis and came to that conclusion. And
I think it's up for debate because what is the consequence of that for American policy with regard to Israel then? That's the question. If it is a genocide, what do we do about that?
Well, I think we need to stop funding Israel and engage in a process where we can rebuild trust between American taxpayers and Israel over what happened there. Because I, like many American taxpayers, are outraged that my tax dollars went to support the killing of tens of thousands of innocent people.
And then Paul also wanted to know about solar development and agribusiness and mixed use, you know, fields that would have solar panels. You do see increasing numbers of solar panels on farm fields across Illinois. I know some Republican lawmakers in Congress have tried to push back on some of that, saying they don't want to see farmland turn to solar energy development. What do you think about that?
I think we let landowners use their land the way that they want to use it. And from my perspective, being a solar entrepreneur, you know, solar development on farmland is a boon to farmers because it values their land at higher than agricultural use value. And many times, not all the time, but many times they can still farm their land even if it has solar panels installed on it. It's an emerging field called agrivoltaics. And so the putting solar panels on farmland can be a real boon to farmers, especially in this age, like Paul said, where they're are these huge agribusinesses and that are really squeezing family farms.
A couple of quick answers to these because we only have a few minutes left. We heard from Sam in Springfield asking all of our candidates, will you vote for a new Democratic leader to replace Chuck Schumer?
Absolutely.
And what about the filibuster? What do you think of that?
I think the filibuster needs to end.
Say a little bit more. Why? Like, Dick Durbin is a big fan. He's a big fan of regular order in the Senate. Seems to constantly still be trying to push us back and hold out a hand toward the Republicans in the Senate to hope for better days ahead. Do you think that's wrong?
I do, yeah. I've been watching the modern Republican Party now for my entire adult life, and I just don't see them reaching back. And so I don't think that keeping the filibuster really does anything other than jams up progress for the American people. We see bills by both parties pass the House only to die in the Senate. And I don't understand the concept of having a upper legislative chamber if it can't pass any legislation through it.
This will probably be our last question. You're a Chicago lawyer. The ads kind of write themselves. What do you say to voters downstate where President Trump remains popular, or at least was elected overwhelmingly in a lot of places, that you would represent them as well as you would your neighbors in Chicago?
I would start by saying it's a fair suspicion to have of a liberal Chicago lawyer. But I'm coming from here, a new generation of Democrats. I'm someone who has liked to, both in my professional and personal life, spend time all over the state, professionally, you know, developing solar projects in downstate Illinois, personally camping. I love to take my kids camping all over the state of Illinois. And so I like to, you know, spend time just as much, if not more, to be perfectly honest, downstate and in some of our great state parks than up in Chicago. But I respect and appreciate your skepticism. I think that you should have scrutiny of the Democratic Party because we have largely left rural areas. And I'm traveling all over the state, and I hope I have an opportunity to talk with folks downstate specifically on that issue.
Jonathan Dean is among the Democrats running for U.S. Senate here in Illinois. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Again, you can listen to other interviews in this series on our website, 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. We're up to 12. There are 16 total candidates. We have one or two more scheduled, one more we're trying to get, one who is just not responding to us at all. Stay tuned for those. Coming up tomorrow, on the 21st show. You've heard of doulas, right? People who help women through childbirth with sort of the, you know, sort of the experiential aspects of it. Well, what about helping people with death? The idea of a death or end-of-life doula. Similar, but it focuses on the end of someone's life rather than the beginning. We'll talk with two of them about the work they do. That's all coming up tomorrow on the 21st show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening, and we will talk with you again tomorrow.